He has a significant threat. He could block my sight, fire me, find my grandmother's business to the point where it would no longer be viable, or simply shut it down altogether. They could pay my neighbors and colleagues to spy on me, hire men to rough me up, throw me in jail, arrange for me to meet with an untimely accident, a car crash or something similar. Perhaps a mugging in one of the less savory parts of the city. He delivers the words in a calm tone, yet with each deliberate pause, it's clear how much he's thought about this. That night we shared rum on the veranda. You weren't mugged, were you?
No.
So they already know who you are. They want you to stop.
Yes.
And the roughing up was what, exactly?
A warning.
Has this happened before?
No. I wasn't on their radar before, but now I appear to be.
What changed? I ask.
I don't know.
I don't believe him for a second. He's not a man predisposed to deceit, and the false note in his words rings true in his voice and in his eyes.
What changed? I repeat. I don't know for sure. They were more concerned with their fists connecting with my face than conversation. But if I had to guess...
No. Me? His silence is all the confirmation I need. Oh my God.
I'm going to be sick.
It's not your fault, he adds quickly. But you're here as a journalist, tourism article or not, and no doubt they checked up on us when they learned you would be staying with the family. Perhaps the closer inspection was all it took.
Luis rubs his jaw.
It was only a matter of time before they found out. I knew when my grandmother mentioned you would be staying with us that it might draw the regime's attention. It was my decision to make, my risk to take. I don't regret it for a moment.
I am so sorry. I never wanted to bring trouble to your family, never wanted to be a burden.
I could have stayed at a hotel or...
No. I am tired of worrying, tired of hiding. I don't want to endanger my family, but at the same time, I knew the risk I was taking when I began blogging a few years ago. This was my choice, and I'll deal with the consequences.
Yet now that he's told me the dangers he's faced, I am filled with worry.
How did you get started? I ask.
In the beginning, the blog was more for myself than anything else. It was an outlet, a way to express myself when the walls felt like they were closing in on me. When I choked on all the things I wanted to lecture about in the classroom and couldn't speak of, I had friends who helped me. I would email my thoughts, and they would arrange for others to post them, often from overseas. It's dangerous, but one of my friends, his voice breaks off before the name slips from his lips. I've no doubt he's the sort of man who would die before spilling someone else's secrets. He's good with computers, and feels the same way I do. I couldn't do it without him, and still, worry enters his gaze. He has a wife, children. We're all at risk here. My audience was small enough that I was probably able to operate below their notice for a long time, but it has grown each year. Who knows? With Vilaid's death, the government seems to be cracking down even more.
What will you do?
Are you going to stop? That's what they want, isn't it?
Luis won't meet my gaze, and once again his silence is answer enough.
Is it worth it?
Truly.
It depends on how you measure that, I suppose. Have my words connected with some? Made them think about our government, our way of life?
I hope so.
He gives a self-deprecating laugh. On good days I'm hopeful. On bad days, I wonder why I bother.
But isn't that the point?
They've created a system to wear you down so you're so tired from the weight of it, fighting lines and bureaucracy and the things you need to make it through each day. You don't have any fight left.
He takes a deep breath.
It's difficult spreading your message when the government censors certain words and communications. I don't know how many Cubans read what I write. I'm speaking in the hope someone will hear me, that those outside Cuba will understand what life is like for us. I speak to remind myself I exist. I don't know how to give up. How to not fight for Cuba. To not challenge myself and others to be better, do more, speak out against injustice.
He pauses. Yes, it is worth it.
Does your family know?
We don't speak of it, but I imagine my grandmother and mother suspect.
Cristina, tú.
I've held these opinions for a long time, even if blogging has become a fairly recent development. Cristina worried about my beliefs. She wanted me to keep my head down when we were married, to not agitate the regime.
She'd already lost far too much.
I feel like a coward blogging under a secret identity when others are so brave. Like the ladies in white taking to the streets to protest. But I love my family, and I wanted to protect them.
Besides, when the odds are as stacked against you as they are here in Cuba, you don't play by the rules. The government certainly doesn't.
Was this what my grandmother felt? This fear? Did her wealth and privilege keep her removed from the revolution until it was in front of her and she couldn't look away anymore?
What happens now?
I ask, watching the fan turn, the blades going around and around again. Regardless of what he says, I hate that my presence here put him in the regime's crosshairs, that he's now under increased scrutiny because of me.
I don't know, Luis answers.
For the first time in my life, I know true, bone-chilling fear. For the first time in my life, I understand the precarious frailty of freedom.
Chapter 18. Elisa. Pablo is gone with a kiss and a goodbye. Gone to fight, and I am once again alone. The engagement ring on my finger when I am in private. On a chain under my clothes when I am not. We hear bits and pieces about the fighting, but there are no letters. No surprise visits to Havana. He has gone to war, and I am left at home to wait for his return. They're fighting in Santa Clara now, and without his letters I'm greedy for any news I can glean. I attempt to overhear my father's conversations, scanning the newspaper for any mentions of the battle. My brother is absent as well, and I shudder to think of the trouble he could be in, of the danger that faces them both. Should I have left with Pablo? I can't imagine myself in the countryside, and at the same time I miss him terribly. I am torn between my heart and my head, between love and loyalty. We celebrate Noche Buena with our usual feast, a whole roasted pig, yuca, black beans and rice, flan for dessert, the champagne flowing freely, conversation veering from politics, from anything too controversial. The extended family gathers. Aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. A house full of Pérezes. We line up on the giant marble staircase in the entryway, the four of us in the front row in our best dresses. Our parents beaming with pride despite the gap in the photo. The missing sibling who should be photographed beside us. The next morning, my sisters and I crowd in front of the Christmas tree and open presents, while our parents sip coffee and smile indulgently. I've always loved Christmas, no matter how old I am. Christmas feels like magic, a cleansing of sorts that wipes away the slate for the year, heralding the beginning of good things to come. This year, they are fighting again. While I feast on roast pork and my family sips French champagne, Pablo and Alejandro are, I don't even know where. Santa Clara? Somewhere out there, in the mountains, on the coast, in the countryside. When we attend Mass for Christmas, I sit in the pews of the Cathedral of Havana, my head bent in prayer, my fingers steepled together. I'm not even sure what I'm praying for anymore. For the rebels to succeed? For Batista to fall? For the rebels to lose and for things to remain as they are? The only constant in my prayers, the only words that fill my head, are for them to be safe. I think I could bear anything else if God or whoever is up there keeps Pablo and Alejandro safe. It begins with a murmur after midnight, spreading throughout the New Year's party. We're at a family friend's house in Miramar, the ballroom crammed with Havana society, save for a few missing this evening. They're saying on the radio that Guevara's forces have taken Santa Clara. I jerk, the untouched champagne sloshing in my glass. Beside me, Beatriz stills. We're dressed in designer gowns our mother ordered us from New York months ago, our organza skirts gliding across the dance floor, the light from the sparkling chandelier above our heads making our jewels glimmer and shine. Isabel dances with Alberto. Maria is off in the corner with some of her friends. Ana stands next to Beatriz. The murmur grows. Someone saw cars loaded with suitcases on the road to the airport. Beatriz grabs my arm, her nails biting into my skin. My gaze darts to my parents, standing at the opposite end of the room, some intrinsic need to search for reassurance driving me, as though I am a young girl once more, and they will tell me all will be right in the world. My mother's face has gone white. My father's expression is grim. Batista announced his plans to leave the country, another person proclaims. He's taking over 100 of his advisors and friends with him. And suddenly, the absences make sense. The men and women who should be here, the children I've played with who are not. And more than anything, there's a sharp stab of panic. The realization that if what they're saying is true, we have been left behind. The murmur transforms into a shout. President Batista has fled the country! Long live a free Cuba! The evidence of how divided we are as a country could not be more terrifyingly obvious than at this moment. For some, the news that Batista has fled, abandoning us to Fidel and his men, is met with the kind of exuberance that suggests they've been pretending all along, their bodies bowed in obeisance as hatred filled their hearts. For the rest of us, a deathly calm has settled over the crowd. It is fear. Bone-deep fear. My mother is the first to move, organizing us until we stand in a huddle of Perez girls, our pastel gowns crushed together. We need to go home. Now! It's the first time I can ever remember my mother commanding my father to do anything. But there's no question now that she's in charge. None of us speak as the band begins playing, people cheering and dancing, champagne flutes rising in the air. I follow behind Isabel, Maria's hand in my free one, my stomach pitching and swaying with each step. It takes a few minutes for us to push our way through the throng, the alcohol and news loosening everyone's limbs. It's as if they've decided that for a few hours, the space between Batista leaving and Fidel reaching the city, Cuba is without a ruler, and they are determined to make the most of it. With every step, though, my gaze connects with someone else in the crowd wearing an expression I fear mirrors my own. What will become of us now?
Chapter 19. Marisol. The next morning I'm equal parts nerves and anticipation. We're headed to Santa Clara today, and I can't wait to meet Magda. Earlier, as we lingered over coffee in the hotel room, our hands linked, Luis's lips brushing against mine, his free arm wrapped around my waist. I called to let Magda know we were coming, a lump forming in my throat at the emotion in her voice. I can't believe I'll finally meet her. I follow Luis outside to his car, waiting while he holds the door open for me, as he walks to the driver's side, uncoiling his long frame into the front seat. The engine comes to life in a series of fits and starts, a few whispered prayers from Luis, the caress of his fingers against the dashboard. Are we going to be okay to get to Santa Clara? He grins and shrugs. We'll find out. After a few words for the Virgin Mary, the car settles into a rhythm, the engine plugging along as we pull out onto the road. I struggle to push aside my worry over our future, over the risk Luis is taking with his writing, the danger I've brought into his life. So what answers are we looking for here? He asks, our bodies tucked against each other. One night has changed so much, the brush of skin against skin. The mingling of breaths has rearranged space and time. Our hands are linked, resting against the convertible's worn leather seat, our bodies as close as the car's interior will allow. It's the most natural thing in the world now, to accentuate our drive with casual touches, his hand running through my hair, my head on his shoulder, our legs against each other. I don't know, I answer. I'm hoping my grandmother trusted Magda, confided in her, and I'm excited to see Santa Clara. He fought there. At least I think he did. His last letter mentioned he was joining Che.
In the Battle of Santa Clara?
Luis asks, his tone laced with interest, the history professor back in full force. Yes. What do you know about it?
It's romanticized and vaunted as the turning point of the revolution. Batista had 3,000 men in Santa Clara. They had tanks, machine guns, mortars. There were 300 rebels.
And my grandmother's love was one of them.
By all accounts, the rebels should have been annihilated. They were outgunned, outmanned. Batista knew the importance of defeating the rebels once and for all, and this was supposed to be his chance. Instead, it became his Waterloo.
What happened?
In the end, it wasn't the guns that decided the victory, but rather the spirit of the men. At least that's what the history books say.
Luis shrugs.
The Cuban military was tired. They'd been fighting their own citizens in skirmishes for a very long time, and it was difficult to ignore the abuses of Batista's regime. The rebels simply wanted it more, and the locals helped the rebel forces.
Did anyone die?
Yes, although that is disputed. There were injuries and some deaths, but as with so much involving the government, the truth has been obfuscated. Truth in Cuba is constantly being redefined, so much so that it is now meaningless.
Are there sights to see surrounding the Battle of Santa Clara?
Maybe I'll include it in my completely neglected travel article. You can visit the train tracks where the battle took place, the box carriages and bulldozer that derailed the train. Santa Clara is a shrine to Che. There's a museum in the city, and he's buried in a mausoleum under a giant bronze statue of himself. The last most important battle of the Cuban Revolution, and he was the one to lead it, not Fidel. That had to burn.
Luis laughs.
Yes, I imagine it did. You can see why there's so much speculation about rancor between the two. Concerns that Che's legacy would overshadow the bearded one's. Suspicion that Fidel played a role in his death in Bolivia.
I would like to see it, if we can. Visit the town, get a feel for the place where they fought.
This isn't just about finding the perfect resting place for your grandmother, is it? You're looking for something for yourself, too.
Luis says, glancing at me again. I guess I am. I stare at the countryside surrounding us. I came here to learn about my family's history, to find the perfect place to spread my grandmother's ashes. But now I'm more confused than ever. When my plane touched down, I thought I'd come home. I'm as Cuban as I am American, as I am Spanish, and yet, until now, I'd never been here. I don't have a tangible connection to this place. My grandmother, my great-aunts kept Cuba alive for me. And now my grandmother's gone, her sister Isabel deceased, my remaining great-aunts growing older, and my sense of being Cuban is slipping through my fingers. Yes, there's a strong Cuban community in South Florida, and I speak Spanish, and ring in the new year with grapes and a bucket of water, and eat lechon asado and listen to Celia Cruz. But there's an aimlessness to it all. I'm not grounded in anything. My feet didn't touch Cuban soil until I was 31 years old, and now that I'm here?
You've all moved on. There's a modern Cuba now with a rich history and emerging cultures and experiences, and I'm not part of that. None of my family are.
We left, and we haven't been able to return, and we're stuck in stasis in the United States. Always waiting, always hoping, wondering, praying that we would wake up and see a headline on the news that Fidel had died, that the government had admitted this was a terrible mistake, that things will go back to the way they were. As exiles, that hope is embedded in the very essence of our soul, taught from birth. Next year in Havana. It's the toast we never stop saying because the dream of it never comes true. And if it does one day, what then? There are Russians in the home my ancestors built. What will we return to? Is it even our country anymore, or did we give it up when we left? I'm trying to understand where I fit in all of this. I take a deep breath, the pressure building in my chest. I walk down these streets and I look out to the sea, and I want to feel as though I belong here. But I'm a visitor here, a guest in my own country. Luis takes my hand.
Then you know what it means to be Cuban, he says. We always reach for something beyond our grasp.
We make good time arriving in Santa Clara an hour before Magda expects us. We head first to the Tren Blindado, the monument to the turning point in the Battle of Santa Clara, when Che and some of his rebel forces derailed the armored train containing reinforcements for Batista's forces, ultimately defeating them.
There were two major efforts in the Battle of Santa Clara, Luis explains. The battle led by Che to take the train involved a small group of his men. The larger contingent fought near Capiro's Hill.
We pay the entry fee and take a quick tour. I snap a few pictures, the infamous yellow bulldozer that derailed the train, the railroad cars lying around like broken dolls. I try to envision the man from my grandmother's letters here, holding the mortar in his hands that's now affixed to the wall, contained in a glass case. Did he think of my grandmother as he fought? Did he know how much this battle would determine Cuba's future? We bypass the museum and mausoleum where Che is buried, although his statue is impossible to miss, looking down at us, a colossus in bronze. We make our way to the Loma del Capiro, the infamous hill where the second prong of the battle took place. It has the added advantage of looking down over the city, providing a panoramic sweep of Santa Clara. Two flags fly, the Cuban flag, and the flag of Fidel's 26th of July movement. Below them lies the city where the revolution took place. It looks like it's been forgotten and neglected, the buildings in a state of disrepair. Tourists mill around, snapping pictures and chatting in different languages. The events here happened almost 60 years ago, and yet it feels so personal, I murmur to Luis, ducking my head to avoid the crowd. I look into his eyes, searching there, trying to read the emotions in his gaze. He's so guarded at times, adept at hiding what he thinks and feels. I suppose in a country like this, that shield is a necessity. The difference between life and death. But there are hints, no matter how good he is. His feelings lingering beneath the surface. The passion and conviction in his voice unmistakable. He yearns for a different Cuba, too. Magda Villarreal lives in a small apartment near the Parque Leoncio Vidal. Her home is one of many stacked on top of one another, and smashed together in a squat building with a crumbling facade. We climb the stairs to her floor. Her living conditions are a stark contrast to the Rodriguez home in Miramar. It's loud, even in the hallway, the walls offering little privacy between residents. There's a faint odor in the air, damp lingering in the floor, ceiling, and walls. Trash litters the stairwell. The railing is cracked and broken in places. The steps chipped, tile trunks missing.
Is it like this in most Cuban apartments?
Luis finishes, his tone grim, his voice low. I nod.
It's even worse. By Cuban standards, this isn't bad at all.
Even in a country where everyone is supposed to be equal, there are clear disparities between those who have little and those who have less. Luis knocks on the door to Magda's apartment, and we wait, the sounds of her footfalls padding across the floor growing louder and louder until they stop. The door swings open, and a short woman with dark skin and dark hair sprinkled with gray greets us on the other side. I've never seen pictures of her. None remain. But there's that same sense of recognition I had when I saw Ana Rodriguez for the first time. Magda's eyes well with tears.
Elisa's little girl, come to see me.
Her hand shakes as she takes mine, her frail fingers gripping me, a tremor in her grasp, the bracelets on her bony wrist clanging together. I never thought I'd see any of them again. And now you're here. Her lips curve into a smile.
You have the look of your grandmother.
Her eyes twinkle. And perhaps a bit of Beatrice. I laugh. the sound muffled by the emotions clogging my throat. I've heard that. Thank you so much for inviting us to your home. Magda ushers us into the tiny apartment, motioning for us to sit. She chats with Luis for a moment, asking about his grandmother, the affection in her voice obvious. I look around the apartment as they talk. The space is filled with framed photographs of her family and friends. A small table covered in a white cloth sits in a corner, painted figurines atop it. They share the space with a few photographs, a crucifix, rosary, several candles, and a cup filled with what looks to be water. Despite Castro's desire to ban religion in Goa, people have found ways to honor their faith, both in the pews of the Cathedral of Havana and here, with this offering to the Santeria gods and goddesses. It's a quiet act of defiance, but a powerful one all the same. Magda excuses herself for a moment, returning with drinks. She settles on the chair opposite us, the fabric fraying at the edges. By looking at her, I never would have guessed she's as old as she is, and her manner is that of a woman a decade or so younger. In all the stories my grandmother told me of Goa, she always spoke of Magda as a woman who raised her, a surrogate mother of sorts, and now I understand that was another thing my grandmother and I shared. Our lives were shaped by strong women who raised us as their own. I answer Magda's questions about my great-aunts, my grandmother, telling her the story of my grandmother's ashes. The emotion that snuck up on me before, the grief, is absent in this little room, and instead I am filled with joy talking about my family. I can easily imagine my grandmother next to me, interjecting throughout this conversation, sharing confidences and stories. I hear her in Magda's voice, see her in Magda's eyes. That's the thing about death. Even when you think someone is gone, glimpses of them remain in those they loved and left behind. Luis sits beside me, sipping his espresso, his knee resting against mine, his presence reassuring. An hour passes as we catch up on each other's lives, and then I ask Magda about the letters. I have some questions about my grandmother. Anna thought you might be able to shed some light on them. Of course. What would you like to know? I found a box of my grandmother's things. I tell her about the letters. Did you know about him? Yes. I lean forward in my seat. Well, I knew some of it, she clarifies. Those last days, their last days in Goa, were heartbreaking for Elisa. The last day I saw her, a tear trickles down her cheek. What happened? Magda sighs. Family left. It was a terrible day. We weren't supposed to know, of course. They pretended they were going for a trip. They would do that, your great-grandmother and the girls. Go to Europe or America to shop. They were careful. All it took was the wrong word overheard and repeated to the wrong person, especially for a family like the Pérezes. She makes the motion of a beard over her face. We all know who the bearded one is. Fidel. I knew, though, when I looked in my girls' faces. Isabel took it the hardest at first. Her fiancé stayed behind. Isabel was never one for talking about her emotions. Eventually, her sisters would pry whatever was bothering her out of her, and she'd open up to them. But it took time. Beatriz was angry, Magda continues. She was always fired up about something. Your great-grandfather loved her best. No matter how hard he tried to act like he loved his girls equally, you could tell. She drove him crazy, but he loved her. They got into a fight in his study the night before they left. I wasn't trying to eavesdrop, but you couldn't help but overhear. The whole house listened to them, carrying on. She didn't want to leave, didn't want to give Fidel the satisfaction of winning. That sounds like Beatriz. Maria was the baby, of course. The girls all tried to shield her as much as they could. Alejandro. Her voice breaks off as she makes the sign of the cross over her body. A lump swells in my throat. I've grown so used to my great-uncle's name evoking that same reaction among his sisters. Your grandmother was my favorite, Magda whispers conspiratorially. I didn't have children then. I hadn't met my husband yet. Elisa was mine as much as she was your great-grandmother's. In those days, the nannies raised the children, not like now. I dried Elisa's tears, held her when she was in pain. And after what happened with that boy, my heart pounds. The revolutionary? Yes. Please, what did she tell you about him? Magda's expression darkens. He was trouble. I knew it from the first moment she mentioned him. Did she tell you his name? No, she never did. Disappointment fills me. We've come this far in our search only to be back where we started. She didn't want to tell me about him at first, of course, but then she didn't have much of a choice, Magda continues. She was scared, and she needed help with the baby. It takes a moment for her words to register, to hear them over the white noise rushing through my ears. I'm sorry, what did you say? She blinks. I assume that was why you wanted to know about him, because of the baby. What baby?
Chapter 20. Elisa. It's strange how the world around you can change in the blink of an eye. How the difference between a few hours can mean everything. In one moment it was 1958 and the world was one thing. Minutes passed and then it was 1959, and the world as we knew it disappeared. The morning light confirms what we learned last night. Batista has fled and left us in the hands of the men marching into Havana from the countryside, the Sierra Maestra. Is Pablo with them? What will become of my brother? Their return is the only glimmer of hope in all of this, and I cling to it now. Gossip filters in throughout the day. The neighbors are out, Anna's parents stopping by, everyone gathering around the television and radio, attempting to discern what will happen next. They say the fighters are coming back, pouring in from the mountains, carrying weapons and dressed in olive-green fatigues, flaunting long, scraggly beards. It appears as though the victory has caught them nearly as off guard as it has caught the rest of us. Batista seemed like an inevitability we would always suffer. Fidel is a looming unknown. I sit in the house with my parents, my sisters, making idle conversation. No, I didn't realize the Mendozas fled with Batista. What a shame we didn't get to say goodbye. Workers are striking. The city celebrating. But our street in Miramar is eerily quiet, except for the trickle of neighbors. Everyone cites a friend of a friend when they give their information. Everyone speaks with an air of authority as though they possess a map for the future. By the afternoon I can't take it anymore. My stomach is in knots, dizziness hitting me in waves, and I crave the fresh air. The atmosphere in the house is like being closeted in a sick room. I flee to my room, changing into a pair of trousers and a cotton blouse, sliding my most serviceable pair of sandals onto my feet. A knock sounds at my bedroom door, and Magda walks in just as I am finishing dressing, her eyes widening as she takes in my appearance. Absolutely not! I don't bother denying my intent. She knows me too well for that. I want to see what the streets look like. I want to look for Pablo. Her mouth tightens in a firm, disapproving line. I can tell you what they look like, the same as they did with Machado. You don't want to be out in that mess. Just for a moment. Please don't tell my parents. What is this about? Really? I want to go to the house where Pablo stayed the last time he was in the city. I want to know if he's returned to Havana. I need to see him. I have a friend. He was fighting in Santa Clara. Elisa! Only Magda could say my name in such a way that I felt compelled to confess all my sins. He's more than just a friend, I whisper. What have you done? It's the worry in her voice that tugs at me. With my parents, I would expect condemnation. But with Magda, I only find concern. The knot in my stomach tightens. I fell in love. She closes her eyes, her lips moving as though in prayer. He's a good man, I protest. You play a dangerous game. Your family, I know. I only want to see that he's back safely, that he's all right. I don't tell her the rest of it. There are some things I'm not ready to share. She shakes her head, making the sign of the cross over herself. May the saints preserve us. I walk down the Paseo del Prado, Magda beside me, her arm tucked in mine, a worried expression on her face. No matter how hard I tried to convince her to stay home, she wouldn't be dissuaded. No one even noticed us leaving. They were so thoroughly engrossed in the tale of Batista's exodus. Magda's strides quicken with each step, her gaze sweeping around. The streets are crowded, people talking and laughing, evidence of the strike everywhere you look. They are clearly ready to give Fidel a hero's welcome. I overhear pieces of conversations. Someone let pigs loose in one of the mob's casinos. My heart pounds as we turn down street after street until we reach the building where Pablo was staying. Two children sit on the front steps throwing a ball around, a dog lying beside them. Magda follows me inside, refusing to leave me when I climb the stairs to the second floor. A wave of dizziness hits me again, and I regret not eating the lunch my mother served at the house earlier. After one bite, it tasted like sawdust in my mouth. My hands tremble when I reach Pablo's front door, as I knock on the wood. Magda's disapproval over the condition of the apartment building is stamped all over her face. No one answers. I knock again this time, louder, my knuckles moving in desperation. The door opposite Pablo's opens, a woman sticking her head out, her gaze running over Magda and me. What do you want? She demands. I'm looking for the man who lives here. Her gaze narrows, clouded with suspicion. No one has been around for weeks. Disappointment fills me. If he comes back, will you tell him a woman was here looking for him? She shrugs before closing the door behind her, the sound of a child's cries filling the hallway. I sag against the wall. Are you ready? Magda asks. This is not the kind of neighborhood you want to be in once the night comes. I nod, my eyes welling with frustrated tears. We leave the building, walking down the street, heading toward our car. The crowd appears to have swelled since we first entered the apartment, more and more people clogging the streets, their voices growing louder, the frenzy magnified. I curse my stupidity, the foolishness that had me taking to the streets looking for him. My voice is strained. We need to get home. I've never seen the city like this. It's a jubilant madness, but madness just the same. A man wielding a bat in his hands runs up to one of the parking meters, smashing it over and over again, his face contorted in fierce determination. Whack! Whack! The change inside clangs together before the machine tips over, smashing to the ground, coins spilling all over the concrete sidewalk. People swoop in, children, their parents, scooping up the money. What surprises me most, what terrifies me most, is the anger. It's as if they've kept a tight lid on their emotions, letting the fury fester for years, contained by Batista's policies, Batista's injustices. And now that he's gone, their anger has shifted, threatening everything in its path. Magda's grip on me tightens as our strides lengthen, the mob swelling. How long before they turn their attention from the parking meters to us? My heart pounds when we reach the car, my hands shaking as I struggle to open the door. It takes two attempts for me to wrest the handle and pull the door open. My fingers tremble as I sit in the driver's seat and start the car. I'm so sorry. I should have never tried to go out today. I had no idea it would be like this. It was like this in 33. With Machado, Magda says, her voice grim. It will get worse before it gets better. I'm afraid she's right, and the anger bubbles up inside me, threatening to overflow. I'm angry at the men on the street, angry with Batista, Pablo, my brother. What did they usher into this country? We're silent on the drive back, and it's only once we're in the safety of the big house, behind the gates again, that I feel some semblance of peace, and even that is short-lived. How long before the violence comes here? Magda follows me to my bedroom, sitting beside me while I sink down onto the bed. Promise you won't go out like that again. I nod, a wave of nausea hitting me. I promise. That boy! I've been carrying this secret for far too long, and I need to tell someone. The words tumble out. I'm pregnant. It is a truly bizarre thing to know your body for 19 years, to grow used to it, its habits and quirks, and then to have it change on you so unexpectedly. It began slowly a few weeks after the last time we saw each other. An urge to nap during the day, a bitter taste in my mouth, nausea constant. I eschewed my favorite foods for things I never enjoyed before, my emotions heightened. By the time I missed my period, I knew. I was late, and I was never late, and my body erased any doubt from my mind. Magda hovers over me now that she knows about the baby, feeding me more food than I can possibly eat, encouraging me to nap, stroking my hair, praying beside me. Even as I worry about the baby, about the uncertainty of my future, the troubles in Cuba's future loom large. Fidel has named Dr. Manuel Urrutia Yeo as the provisional president, but everyone says Castro will be the one pulling the strings anyway. The airport has been shut down. No one can get flights out of the country. Our driver reported seeing American tourists sitting on the front lawn of the Hotel Nacional, their suitcases in hand, fear and anger etched on their faces. They were finally evacuated by ship to Key West. And it's not just the airport. The whole country is under general strike. Our father's been making angry phone calls all morning, trying to figure out what's happening with his workers. Mobs have opened the doors at El Príncipe, letting the prisoners escape. Havana has descended into madness. I'm back in the house, perched on a silk couch in our elegant sitting room, surrounded by paintings in heavy gold frames. They ransacked El Encanto, my mother says, her lips pursed in a tight line. There is no greater sin in her mind than the destruction of haute couture. I imagine all those dresses we used to try on, now in apartments throughout Havana, worn by those who admired them in magazines. We used to find a little bit of magic in those dresses. Will that same magic rub off on their new owners?
They got the casinos, too, my father says. No one is doing anything to stop them. The military, the police. They've all simply given up. They're giving our country away without a fight, he thunders.
Are they going to come here? For us? Maria asks. My mother pales.
Don't say that! Don't ever say that! She snaps.
What? Maria looks bewildered. They want money, don't they? We have money.
My father ignores her.
They're patrolling the streets now. They say the 26th of July has pushed the police force out.
His face turns red.
People are hanging signs outside their houses thanking Fidel. For what? Do they really think he is on our side? He preaches peace and democracy while he prepares to feast on the carcasses of his enemies. He has made fools of all of us, mark my words, and I fear far worse before the month is out.
Chapter 21. They swarm into the city in a steady flow of green uniforms and beards. They carry guns in their hands, and I cringe at the cold black metal, at the manner in which they survey their surroundings as though Havana belongs to the 26th of July. They're good-natured in their victory,
But then victors can always afford the luxury of happiness. For the rest of us, I scan each face looking for Pablo, searching, equal parts hoping to find him, equal parts afraid I will. I fear it would break my heart to see his face, his body in those odious fatigues. And yet the absence of him brings its own pain. Surely he'll come to me. And my brother. No one knows where Alejandro is or what he's doing. Has he aligned himself with the 26th of July? Is he their enemy? We are inundated with images of Fidel marching toward the city, taking his time, prolonging the 600-mile journey like a predator savoring his kill. The nauseous feeling in my stomach doesn't subside.
They've recognized Fidel's government,
my father says. They? My mother asks.
The Americans.
And the elections?
In 18 months, or 2 years.
My father's mouth tightens.
In the meantime, the president, controlled by Fidel, has removed all political figures appointed by Batista. Some of his cabinet members have sought asylum in foreign embassies. Others have been arrested.
He doesn't say the rest, but I know. Others have been executed by firing squad. My father rattles off a list of names, men who came and dined at my mother's infamous Parisian dinner table, who gave us mints and sweets when we were children, men whose sons I danced with, whose daughters I knew well. My mother's cries drown out the rest of the names. My hand drifts to my stomach, my palm resting protectively against the silk fabric. What world am I bringing this child into?
They've frozen the assets of Batista's officials, my father says.
My mother's eyes widen with alarm.
And our investments?
They can't touch the money overseas. That's something, at least. The president of the National Bank is gone. Same with the Agricultural and Industrial Bank.
More friends of my father's.
They say Batista is in Santo Domingo now, taking refuge with Trujillo.
He's in good company, then. The Dominican president is a longtime friend of Batista's, and as much of a tyrant.
Many of Batista's closest advisors are with him, waiting this thing out until it is safe to return.
My father doesn't say more, but I hear the unspoken worry in his voice, the push and pull. Should we leave, or should we stay? We gather in front of the television that evening. The room silent as we watch Fidel speak in front of the crowds at Camp Columbia, the military barracks in Havana. There must be thousands of people there. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. He's surrounded by a sea of Cubans looking to him as though he is the answer to everything they've ever hoped for, prayed for. A week ago, a different man stood there, sneaking out of the country he controlled for many years, leaving us with this. Earlier, tanks and trucks rolled through the city, as though we're being occupied by an invading army, rather than liberated by one of our own. They've opened Camp Columbia's gates, and the space is filled with Fidel's compatriots, with ordinary Cubans. They come to see Fidel, their messiah. He is still relatively unknown throughout Havana, a Robin Hood figure of sorts, but they know one important thing about him. He is not Batista. They hated Batista. But it is clear that Fidel is no savior either. There are no saints in Havana. I wake the next morning and the sky is duller, the air thick and cloying, last night's spectacle casting a pall over the entire city. I join my sisters in the dining room for breakfast. Our parents have disappeared somewhere in the house. The more Fidel inserts himself into Havana, the more my parents retreat. What would the corsair have done? Would he have taken up arms and fought? Or would he have taken his pretty French wife and their child and hied off in his great big ship for better lands? More people are leaving each day. Friends of my father's, friends of Batista's. Fidel and his cohorts are obsessed with purging the country of anyone tied to the old regime. But what happens when they've spilled all the Batista loyalist blood there is to spill? Who will they come for next? The food tastes like sludge in my mouth, my stomach and the babe rebelling. But I force myself to swallow, shoveling the rich breakfast down my throat. It is entirely too quiet in the house. Our silverware scrapes across bone china. Only Maria seems content to sit in silence, stifling yawns between bites of her food. The rest of us look shell-shocked. On the streets, people celebrate, the mood of the country jubilant. In our house and so many others like it, we're afraid to venture out, fear the knock on the door. Worry they'll eventually get to our family's name on a list somewhere. Afraid to leave, afraid to stay.
Miss Elisa?
Our maid, Charo, stands in the doorway to the dining room, her eyes wide.
There's a man here to see you,
she whispers, her gaze darting around, no doubt looking for my mother. I hear the word man, and everything else disappears. My sisters ask me questions somewhere in the background, but I don't hear them. I don't even hear the rest of what Charo says before I'm pushing back from the table, walking, nearly running through the house. He's home. Everything will be fine now. He's safe. He's alive. My hand falls to my stomach, caressing our child. My other hand opening the front door, eager to see Pablo, to collapse into his arms. The sunlight hits me first, so bright it's nearly blinding, deigning to break through the clouds and show its face. The sound of people cheering somewhere off in the distance is a dull roar. But that too fades away. A man stands near the front gates, his head ducked, wearing olive green fatigues and a matching cap, a beard covering the lower half of his face. My heart pounds. I walk toward him, my feet moving more quickly now, kicking up stones in the front drive. He's home. We will be married now. He will be so happy about the baby. We'll sort out the rest of it. He's home, and that's all that matters. He looks up as I approach, his dark gaze solemn, and I stop in my tracks, confusion filling me. The eyes that stare back at me aren't Pablo's. It takes a moment for me to recognize the face, another moment still for the words to come to me, bursting through the recesses of my memory.
If anything happens to me while I'm gone, Guillermo will find you. It won't come to that, though, because I'm coming home to you, Elisa. Batista himself couldn't keep me away.
I stop a foot away from the gates, tears filling my eyes, my knees buckling beneath me.
I'm so sorry, Guillermo says.
And then I can no longer hear the rest of his words, for the white noise rushing through my ears, my body collapsing against the earth. Pablo is dead. And Havana is dead. And I am dead.
Chapter 22 Marisol. I sit in the passenger seat, staring at the palm trees waving in the breeze. I don't speak. Magda has taken everything I thought I knew about my family, about my grandmother, about myself, and turned it upside down. The man I knew was my grandfather, who my father believes is his father, isn't really at all. Instead, my biological grandfather was, one of Fidel's men, a man who died fighting in the Cuban Revolution, who gave his life for everything my family stands against. The sheer fact that my grandmother loved a revolutionary was difficult to wrap my mind around. But this?
Do you think your grandfather knew? Luis asks. About the baby?
I try to remember the times I saw them together, how he treated me and my father, my sisters, the love he showed all of us. My grandfather was one of the first people my grandmother met when she arrived in the United States. His family was involved in the early days of the Cuban exile movement, assisting new arrivals to acclimate to life in the United States after Castro took power. His parents, my great-grandparents, left during the Cuban Revolution of 1933. Which ousted then-President Machado, a general who'd fought against Spain in the War for Cuban Independence. My grandfather was born in the United States, and his stories weren't of Cuba, but rather watching Florida grow and change throughout the years. When great-grandfather Perez died, he left his sugar empire, resuscitated from its near demise at the hands of Fidel Castro and his compatriots, to my grandfather, Turan. And so Perez Sugar was for the first time since its inception in the late 1800s run by a Ferreira and not a Perez. According to my grandmother, theirs was a whirlwind courtship. He fell in love with her the first moment he saw her sitting in the living room of a family friend's house in Miami. It took him a month to wear her down, and once he did, they eloped in a simple ceremony in City Hall. I asked her once if she regretted missing out on the big, splashy wedding. Those were difficult times, Marisol. We weren't thinking of gowns or parties anymore. We were mourning. The loss of our country, our family, our friends. And now I understand my grandmother's urgency a bit more. She was pregnant and unmarried in a time when she would have caused a huge scandal and likely added to her family's grief. He had to have known, I answer. She wouldn't have kept it from him, not something like that. Besides, my father was born months after they came to the United States. My grandfather would have suspected based on when the baby was conceived. Magda told me how much my grandmother grieved when she discovered her lover died in Santa Clara. I can only imagine what it must have been like for my grandmother. 19, pregnant, caught in the midst of a revolution, learning the man she loved, the father of her child, was dead. Who could my grandmother have trusted with her secrets after something like that? She'd been forced to leave her best friend and the woman who'd practically raised her in Cuba. My great-grandparents no doubt would have been angry and ashamed, especially given the identity of the baby's father. No wonder she'd ended up with my grandfather. Did he ask her to keep the secret of my father's paternity, or did she choose to do so on her own? I wish... My voice breaks off, and I can't finish the thought. The emotion's pummeling me. I wish I'd known the truth. I wish I'd had a chance to know my biological grandfather, to hear how my grandmother felt about him in her own words. I loved my grandfather, and while I don't remember him well, my memories are of a good man, my memories of my grandparents' marriage a loving one. But this need to know, to understand where I came from, is a powerful urge. Luis starts the car's engine and pulls out onto the road. I glance back at Magda's building. We exchange information and plan on keeping in touch. Your grandmother must have been very brave to survive so many losses, Luis says, his voice gentle. And at such a young age, too. She was. You should be proud of that. And of him. For better or worse, strong blood runs through your veins. You read his letters to her. What sort of man was he? Can you take the measure of a person based on 10 or 20 letters? I don't know. As a writer, I know better than anyone how easily words and emotions can be manipulated. But I do know my grandmother, and I cannot believe she would love a man who wasn't worthy of it. He was a good man. I recall the words he wrote her, the passionate strokes of his pen across the page. A dreamer, a fighter. Then he is an ancestor you can proudly claim. Is it that easy? Was his legacy saved by death? Had he lived through the events of the revolution and everything that came after, would he have spoken out against Fidel's abuses, or would he have turned into a monster himself? The line between hero and villain is a precariously fragile one. I'm sorry he died, Luis says. That you weren't able to find him like you wanted. Me too. This is it. There are no more answers to be found, only questions. I will never have a chance to know the man whose blood runs through my veins. This part of my family is gone now, too, just like my grandmother. When I was searching for her lover, there was still hope. A sense of purpose to my trip here beyond finding her final resting place. Now there's just the unknown, and of course, the uncertainty of my relationship with Luis. He brings our joined fingers to his lips, kissing my knuckles. Everything is going to be okay, he says, as though he can read the thoughts going through my mind. Will it? Ojalá. I smile. The spirit behind the word, something so quintessentially Cuban, something incremental.